From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The idea for today's show came from the movie now playing that has the writer Edgar Allan Poe in the center of a murder mystery. It's actually not that story we're talking about. That story is fiction. But the real Edgar Allan Poe actually did play the role of a detective. In 1842, he was determined to solve the high-profile murder of a beautiful young woman in New York. So he investigated the case, and he used that story and the things he learned as the basis for a piece of fiction. It was a sequel to another book he had written about an eccentric Parisian detective who used the powers of deduction to solve crime. Our guest today is the writer Daniel Stashower. He's written a book about all of this. It's part murder mystery, part biography. It's the story of the beautiful cigar girl. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a new Hollywood movie out these days that puts the writer Edgar Allan Poe in the position of being a detective solving this series of murders. It's an interesting concept, but it's a piece of fiction. The actual real story is more interesting, really. The real Edgar Allan Poe actually did play the role of detective. In 1842, he was determined, became kind of obsessed about solving this high-profile murder of this beautiful young woman in New York. Her name was Mary Rogers. So he investigated the case and used the story and all of these things that he had learned as the basis for a story, a piece of fiction. It was a sequel to another book that he had written about this eccentric Parisian detective who used the powers of deduction to solve crimes. Our guest today is the writer Daniel Stashower, who's written a book about all of this. His book is called The Beautiful Cigar Girl, Mary Rogers, Edgar Allan Poe, and the Invention of Murder. We invite you to join the conversation if you like. If you have questions or comments, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Daniel Stashower is a journalist, a biographer, a mystery writer. He's written about Arthur Conan Doyle and Philo T. Farnsworth. His book about Edgar Allan Poe and Mary Rogers came out several years ago. He has a new biography of Alan Pinkerton coming out later this year. We'll tell you more about that later. And he's joining us today from his home in Bethesda, Maryland. Daniel Stashower, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start by asking you when it was that you... When did you find this story? When did you first come across this story?
Well, as a kid, I really enjoyed reading Poe's stories, like a lot of people. I can remember reading them under the covers with a flashlight. You know, The Telltale Heart and The Oblong Box, Cask of Amontillado.
Yeah.
But when I got to The Mystery of Marie Roget, I couldn't follow it. It didn't make sense. I loved the other stories with Poe's detective Dupin. You mentioned the murders in the Rue Morgue. There was also the purloined letter. But somehow this story, it struck me as a damp squib. It got off to a great start, but then it kind of wandered off. There were extracts from newspapers and a long section on something called postmortem stomach gases. And I just couldn't figure it out. I didn't know what all this stuff meant. And what I didn't understand was that there were exact parallels to a real crime, to a crime that had gripped the city of New York for months and months, and that the details of this story would have made perfect sense to the readers of Poe's day. Mm. So what I wanted to do was not only tell the story of this crime and its many consequences, but I wanted to show how Poe scooped it up and turned it into fiction.
Yeah. Are you a little... bemused by this new movie coming out, which is, you know, I'm sure it's interesting. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm sure it's plenty interesting, but that there's a more interesting story that's actually real. I mean, have people noticed that? Has anyone tried to make a movie about the real part of the story?
You know, there, interestingly enough, and I confess I haven't seen the new movie, although I plan to, the idea of Poe as a crime solver isn't all that far-fetched, because when he, as you mentioned earlier, when he approached this story, when he decided that he was going to write about it, he as much as said as, not only was I going to write about the story, but he intended to solve it. He said, and the exact quote was, "I will indicate the assassin in a manner that would help the police to reopen and perhaps make progress with the investigation."
I wanted to ask you, let me lay out some sort of broad elements to this story that I wanted to ask you about. Do we still have you here, by the way?
Sure thing.
Okay, sorry. And I should mention we're having problems with the line, so forgive us and indulge us for a minute. We're going to try to fix this. But there's some broader issues here I wanted to just mention, and then we can break them down as we go. But there is a kind of broader significance to the story, because you say that in the book that this crime became this catalyst for this sweeping change, and it raised these big questions about what's the role of journalism in, you know, the ethical questions of journalism, this debate about the limits of journalism.
That's a huge, huge part of the story, because when this crime broke, and it broke with the body of this young woman found floating in the Hudson River, the press went absolutely nuts. Then, as now, there was a big gap between the upper and lower extremes of the press, and in those days it was the penny press at the bottom and the more respectable broadsheets at the top. And this is one of the first instances where the lower reaches, the penny press, drove the story and forced the more upper-crust newspapers to get on board or be left at the station. The papers were writing about it, the people were interested, and everyone had to get behind the story, and this in turn led to police reforms.
Let's talk about Mary Cecilia Rogers, explore who she was. She's come to us, I think, in some ways, or at least the people of the time, those familiar with the story, she seems to have sort of come to us as more myth in some ways than reality. Was she really that beguiling? I mean, she was beautiful and mysterious, but is there part of the fact that she died? Did that give her a kind of more mythic status?
I'm sure it did, but I will tell you that at the time, while she was alive, she created something of a sensation. She was the It Girl of 1838. Mm. The entire city was talking about this very beautiful young woman, and men wrote poems about her. They went on and on about her womanly figure, her raven tresses, and her dark smile. And because she was so celebrated for being beautiful, she was hired to work behind the counter of a cigar store. Mm. Because the owner thought that she would bring in customers. And this proved to be very much the case. Soon the store was teeming with male customers, all trying to get her attention. Mm. And she became famous as the beautiful cigar girl.
Yeah.
And this went on for a couple of years before the murder and before she entered into legend as the subject of this unsolved crime.
John Anderson's cigar store there on 319 Broadway. Anderson himself is a pretty interesting and, as we learn later in the book, sort of controversial figure. He's full of energies, full of ambition. And I guess he wanted the place, the tobacco store, to be this gathering place, which, as you say, it turned out to be.
It was a gathering place. It attracted a lot of the city's leading literary lights and its power brokers, and I think Anderson himself hoped that it would be a springboard to greater things for himself. He seems to have had aspirations to political office, and over the years he would discover that his association with this crime that became fairly notorious put a spike in those ambitions.
Yeah. I just think it's so interesting that a woman would become so famous in a city. Surely there were other beautiful women, Daniel Stashower. I mean, there was something really, I guess something amazing about her. What do you figure it was? Just her beauty?
But don't you think in a way that it sort of prefigures a lot of celebrity of today?
Huh.
I mean, that's the way that I was looking at it at the time. I mean, it's not hard to draw parallels between this woman who was famous for being beautiful, and a lot of the celebrities, you know, we have the expression now, famous for being famous. Well, I would it's not too much to say that she was one of the first that you could say that about. I hate to reduce it to simple terms, but in a way, she was the Kardashian of her day.
Right. we should mention that in October of 1838, this is before all this happens, of course, she goes missing. Explain what happens, because this is another kind of twist in the story.
It really was. This is a very peculiar episode, and possibly it is related to what happened to her a couple of years later, and possibly not. But for a brief period of time, in 1838, people are flocking to the cigar store to see her, and she's not there. She has gone missing. Nobody quite seems to know what has happened. And this sparks a lot of talk. Where is she gone? Has some misfortune befallen her? And it's said that when she reappeared, none the worse for the experience, a few days later, she was quite mortified by what had gone on, and in fact stopped working at the cigar store a short time after that. But the impression it left was that she had quite inadvertently sparked a lot of gossip, a lot of whispers, and some notice in the press, and she didn't care for it.
Right. So let's move forward a few years then. July 1841, and Mary Rogers finds herself engaged to be married to a man by the name of Daniel Payne. It's the latter part of the month, July 25th of 1841. It's a Sunday, pretty hot day. Take us from there, Daniel Stashower, of what happens next.
She went off to visit some people. Her fiancé, Mr. Payne, made arrangements to meet her on her return, and she never turned up.
Yeah.
Now, this wasn't unprecedented. She had disappeared earlier. There were certainly explanations for her disappearance that were quite innocuous, but it was a cause for concern. And a few days later, on July 28, 1841, she was found floating in the Hudson River with a lace cord tied tightly around her neck. It was a gruesome, violent death, and it sent the city into shock. And immediately, the speculation started. Everybody had a theory. Some people blamed the gangs of New York, and others blamed a spurned lover. And some said she had committed suicide, which was very bizarre because there were finger mark bruises on her throat, showing that she'd been choked by someone, and certainly you don't see that in suicide. And then there were a number of people who said, no, she wasn't dead. She simply run away with someone, and the body in the Hudson must be someone else's. And this was also a pretty odd theory because her own mother and her fiancé had made the identification. Everybody, it seemed, had a theory except the police. They investigated, but they got nowhere with it.
Alfred Cromlin is another interesting character, an acquaintance of Mary's. He kind of astonishingly comes upon the corpse after it's pulled from the water, kind of protects her from this gawking crowd, which is itself an intriguing story, I have to say, Daniel Stashower. You know, the body, these two guys get in this boat, go and retrieve her body, and they just sort of anchor it to the shore and then walk away. Seems odd and kind of it's a strange scene in some ways, and Alfred Cromlin sort of comes upon it, and there's this crowd sort of kicking at it. It's bizarre.
Very strange and very unpleasant, and I should explain that both Daniel Payne, her fiancé, and Alfred Cromlin were boarders who had rooms at the boarding house that Mary Rogers and her mother kept in New York. So they would have known her, seen her every day, come to know her quite well, and they were rivals for her affection. But as you say, this scene of her body being discovered, it was a very strange and yet It seems that, unfortunately, it was not an unusual thing
for
bodies to turn up floating in the Hudson River at this time, and it was only her notoriety that elevated it to the point where it received so much attention and eventually so much notice in the press.
You know, this question of sex is sort of whispered about. It's an interesting part of the story in some ways. Alfred Cromlin, you say that he sort of takes on the role as not only the spokesman for the family after she's her body is discovered, but you say she also becomes in some ways the guardian of Mary Rogers' memory and her reputation.
This role seems to be one that he claimed for himself. No one thrust it on him. He seemed to think that this was his duty. And, of course, there were certain things that could not be spoken about in the newspapers of the day, certain things that simply were not considered fit for print. And that's where a figure named James Gordon Bennett becomes important.
Yeah.
He was the publisher of the New York Herald. And he saw that there was a sensation in this story, and therefore there was money to be made.
Mm.
He was a figure who was always pushing at the limits. Walt Whitman described him as a reptile marking his path with slime wherever he goes. Now that's Walt Whitman talking, so you can imagine what the non-poets were saying about him. he's often described as the father of yellow journalism.
Yeah.
And he's also a classic story of an immigrant who made good. But he liked to thumb his nose at what he considered to be the false pieties of his competitors. There were things that they wouldn't say, and he took a certain delight in saying them. The conventions of the day were such that you couldn't refer to a woman's undergarments in print. And there were undergarments playing a fairly significant role in this drama. But Bennett, he's like a school kid who's just learned a dirty word.
Yeah.
He writes in the paper, "Petticoats, petticoats, there, you fastidious fools. I've said it." And you can see a certain note of glee arising even in the sordid details of this case just because he's the one who's saying it for the first time.
Yeah. And Bennett is making a lot of money, I mean, with this brand of journalism, which, as you point out in the book, it sort of reveals that his readers had a taste for blood.
Absolutely. A taste for salaciousness and for blood and for the sort of for the soap opera-ish quality of this story. He saw that there was money to be made, and as we all know, he was not the last to do so. He started a real trend.
Mm. So the case is playing out in the public, being tried in the press. And it's interesting you say that it wasn't long before Mary Rogers really becomes, you put it this way, this bankable commodity.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. People were selling souvenirs out at the site of where her body was discovered. Her likeness in etchings and little souvenir pamphlets describing the tragedy began to appear. And people would go out to see the spot and sort of get a chill in the same way that you might visit a haunted house.
When we get back from a break, Daniel Stashower will talk to us about, of course, this one of the central figures anyway in the story, Edgar Allan Poe. His book is called The Beautiful Cigar Girl, Mary Rogers, Edgar Allan Poe, and the Invention of Murder. If you'd like to join us, you can call 801-585-WEST, or our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling the intriguing real-life story of the poet and writer Edgar Allan Poe playing the role of detective. In 1842, he set out to solve the murder of a beautiful young woman in New York. And by using the actual facts in the case as the structure for his writing about this, he helped to create the genre of crime fiction in some ways. The writer Daniel Stashower has written a book about the story. It's called The Beautiful Cigar Girl, Mary Rogers, Edgar Allan Poe, and the Invention of Murder. He's joining us to talk about it. You can join us if you have questions or comments. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Daniel Sesha, I wanted to ask you, let's talk about Edgar Allan Poe. You say in the book that there really are kind of two parts to Edgar Allan Poe's character at play in this story. There's the genius part, and then there's the charlatan part.
Yes, that was something that was often said about him. Today, I think we would call him high maintenance. He had this contrary strain in his nature, even self-destructive. And this played out both in his life and in his fiction. And it's a quality that he recognized in himself. He wrote a story about it. It was called The Imp of the Perverse. Mm. And in it, he as much as said that there were certain conditions where it became absolutely irresistible to do the right thing, to do the wrong thing, rather. Yeah. And what he seems to be saying is that he had demons and he just couldn't help himself.
You write about this constant predicament he's in, of course. He's struggling to make money, forever on calling on friends for loans. And he is, at this particular time, I suppose, or I guess throughout his life, really, sinking into kind of destitution. And he's always, I guess he's looking for the right angle. Is that right?
He was frequently hovering at the very edges of destitution. He dreamed of owning and editing his own magazine, but he frequently wound up working for others, often at very, very low wages. And the miracle of it is that he did as much work as he did. In addition to the stories and the poetry that we know, he also wrote a great deal of literary criticism, and he just kept at it. He kept working, hoping for his chance, but wanting to be a poet.
Falls in love with his rather young cousin, Virginia, goes to New York in 1837, drawn, you say, by the same forces, really, that brought Mary Rogers there. At what point does he learn of the case? I suppose everyone knew of the case, but when was it that he struck upon this idea to write about it? What was it that made it so intriguing in that way, do you think?
Well, he was in New York at the time that she was holding court at the cigar store. Yeah. And it's even said that Poe was a customer of the cigar store, that he bought tobacco from her. There's no telling if that's actually true, but 2 months before the murder, he had published The Murders in the Rue Morgue,
yeah,
the world's first detective story. And it occurred to Poe that he might take this this pioneering detective technique from his story, he called it ratiocination, and he might be able to apply it to a real-life crime. So his intention was not just to write about the crime, but to explore this technique that he had pioneered in the earlier story and see if he could use it in a real-world setting. But there was a deeper connection than that. As tempting as it would have been to him or to any writer or journalist to write about that story, it spoke to him very, very directly. Mm. People like to say that Poe lived a life that read like a Poe story, and that's true, but there were also a lot of elements of Dickens in his life. His father had abandoned him. His mother died of consumption in front of him when he was not quite 3 years old, and he was taken in by a very strict foster father who never formally accepted or adopted him. And the rest of his life would be shadowed by the deaths of the women who were closest to him,
at the time of the Mary Rogers murder, his wife was dying of tuberculosis. So this was obviously a very resonant topic for him. And he once wrote that the death of a beautiful woman is unquestionably the most poetical topic in the world. So in the saga of Mary Rogers, this beautiful young woman who went missing in the most dramatic way possible and then was found dead, he'd found a haunting young woman who might have stepped out of one of his own stories. In many ways, this was the story that Poe was born to write.
So she's the ideal candidate because she's a young, beautiful victim, and there's this idea of melancholy, as you say, injustice, all the things that would have resonated with his art.
Absolutely. Characters like Annabelle Lee, Lenore, they all are aspects of Mary Rogers.
You know, the part about melancholy and all of that, I think, you know, people are familiar with that. I think what's so great about your book, though, Daniel Stashower, is the way you break down Edgar Allan Poe as a detective. It's interesting because you write about the fact that in some ways there's some elements of his life that made him an ideal detective. You write about how he learned to really kind of set aside preconceived ideas and theories and just, as you put it, collect the data because he didn't want to be led one way or another. And he learned this early on to not be influenced, just to sort of set all of that aside and just go with the facts at hand.
That's very true. And there were all sorts of ways in his life and in his career that you can see him sort of gathering the tools that would have made him a very, very good detective, a very, very strong, rational thinker. He particularly liked solving puzzles. And one of the successes he had as a journalist was in challenging readers to submit cryptograms, codes, and puzzles to see if he could solve them. And he liked to say that he would never be stumped. But this was something that he seemed to have a particular facility for, solving puzzles. So when he saw, with this investigation, the police foundering and the public clamoring for a solution, it must have seemed natural to him to see if he could apply those same puzzle-solving techniques to this problem.
Hmm. You say that Poe had been sort of, this thing had been nagging him for years, this idea that when you write a fictional detective story, you just have to write backwards. There's not any real insight or any real imagination in it in some ways, he figured. He wanted real problems to work out. That was what was so original about his idea.
That's the thing. That probably would seem silly to a lot of writers today. But in a way, after he had written The Murders in the Rue Morgue, he wondered if perhaps he wasn't cheating the reader in a little bit, because he knew going in whodunit. He had it figured out. He knew what the answer was. And of course, today we don't look at a mystery novelist and sort of say, well, that's not fair. You knew who the killer was. We accept that that's part of the bargain going in, that the person who writes the book has a pretty fair idea how it comes out in most cases before they start. But Poe felt that this effect that he achieved in the Rue Morgue would have been all the more dramatic if it had been a real case, if it had been a real puzzle that Dupin was solving, and therefore he'd be on absolutely equal footing with anybody else who was attempting to solve the problem.
And it seems like he had this aspiration to reopen the case. I mean, it had been foundering for a while, the case, the investigation. It seems like he really wanted to have an effect on this actual story.
He did. He said as he was writing the story and beginning to send it around to magazine editors that he hoped that it would create a sufficient amount of talk about the case that the police would be forced to take a second look at the investigation.
Now, the figure that the character that he creates, his detective, Dupin, reaches his conclusions in an interesting way through, how does he pronounce it?
It's pronounced a couple of different ways.
Yeah.
Ratiocination or ratiocination.
Cination, yeah.
But it's that beginning of ratio and then cination.
It's basically deductive thinking, I suppose.
Yes. It's a precursor of Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes. And I guess, Daniel Stashower, that must have been one of the parts of the story that must have absolutely enchanted you, I suppose, given your writing about Arthur Conan Doyle.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you see in Dupin a lot of the elements that Conan Doyle would scoop up and use as he was creating Sherlock Holmes. And Conan Doyle admitted that freely. Conan Doyle thought that that Poe was the one of the greats of all time, and he once said something to the effect of, if every story writer who wrote a story that owes its springs to Edgar Allan Poe were to pay him a tithe towards a monument, he would have something like the pyramids of Egypt built in his honor. He felt that that a tremendous amount of modern literature, but of course particularly crime fiction, came directly from Poe and would not have existed without him.
Mm. So this is his idea. He's going to take this real-life murder mystery and he's going to investigate it, and then he's going to write a story about it using fictional characters. So that's his scheme. And you begin the book with this letter that he writes to a friend of his to see if he would be interested in the idea. Ultimately, his friend doesn't bite. He's not interested. But he does get some people interested in the idea. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, the story was published, and it was a very, very, still is, a very, very long story.
Yeah.
So it was published in three installments. The first one appeared, certainly gained some notoriety. The second one came out, and the conversation heats up a bit. And then, in between the publication of the second one and the third installment, the final installment, in which Poe is going to reveal his solution, there's an actual break in the case.
Yeah.
The real investigation suddenly takes a turn. And Poe suddenly finds himself in a very tight spot. And what he wound up doing is very, very interesting. It was very late in the day. There was not time to do very much. So he went and made a small handful of very, very small, tiny, but significant changes to the third installment before it ran. So that he would be seen to have very nearly hit the mark about this break in the case.
Yeah.
He wanted to get ahead of the story, and this was his instincts as a journalist taking over for his instincts as a fiction writer.
And on some levels, I suppose it worked. I mean, you talk about in the book how he recaptured the story, bent it to his will, is how you put it.
He did, yes. He absolutely, to this day, it is assumed by many people that he cracked the case, that he solved it. The truth is that this story was kind of the Black Dahlia of its day. It was never, the case was never officially solved. So Poe's story has become the reality for a lot of people. People believe that his explanation, which involved a mysterious naval officer, was correct. This says as much about the astonishing force of Poe's story as it does about the actual case. The remarkable thing about the actual case is that as early as 1874, which is only a few decades after the case had happened, one of Poe's early biographers actually had to step aside and say, look, this was a real woman. Mary Rogers was an actual person and not simply a figure of Poe's imagination, because his explanation of the case had become so much more alive in the public imagination than the story itself.
Daniel Stashower is with us. His book is The Beautiful Cigar Girl, Mary Rogers, Edgar Allan Poe, and the Invention of Murder. We need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer Daniel Stashower. We're talking about his book, The Beautiful Cigar Girl, Mary Rogers, Edgar Allan Poe, and the Invention of Murder. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So, Daniel Stashower, do you figure, do you have your own hunch about what happened to Mary Rogers?
Yes. But the problem is that there's no single theory that seems to cover all of it. It was widely believed at the time that that this was an abortion gone wrong.
Right.
That she had removed herself from she sort of detached herself from Daniel Payne, her fiance, gone away for the day, and what she was going to do was slip away and go to one of the many places around New York where you could terminate a pregnancy at that time. One of the sad ironies of researching this case is that in many New York papers of the day, after her disappearance, there would be stories about Mary Rogers on the front page and in the back page, advertisements for these various abortion parlors. One of them was called Madame Ristel's.
Yeah.
And you'd see these advertisements, you know, plain as day. And it was thought that obviously the techniques were primitive, and a lot of the people doing this work were very poorly trained, not at all qualified, and mishaps happened all too frequently. The thing about the Mary Rogers case, though, is that she was found with damage on her body as though she had been beaten up, and with a cord tied tightly around her neck, sinking deeply into the flesh of her throat. So this one theory that, oh gosh, it was just this terrible accident that went wrong, doesn't quite cover it. But possibly there had been a separate incident, or there were marks, there was damage done to the body to cover what had really happened. But there's no easy explanation, and indeed, if there had been, it's far more likely that the case would have been solved at the time.
Mm. This is where John Anderson sort of comes back into the story. He was the owner of the cigar store. And there's this theory, this concept that he somehow had commissioned Edgar Allan Poe to write a book to cover his tracks.
Yes. That's a theory that's been around for a long time, because Anderson's reputation did suffer from his association with this. It was thought that he had had something to do with her death, or at least with her disappearance. And he often blamed her in later life for having thwarted some of his ambitions, because he never quite got back on his feet afterwards. It must be said that if you wanted to distract attention from your association with this horrific crime, possibly the worst thing you could have done would be to hire Edgar Allan Poe to write a story about it.
Right.
Because the truth is, this episode would be all but forgotten today if Poe hadn't written the story about it. But, of course, the case could be made that that Anderson hoped that Poe would direct attention in another area and away from him. But that did not turn out to be the case.
Time after time, there is another dramatic element comes up. Daniel Payne, the man she was going to marry,
He
he essentially kills himself in this story just a few, what is it, a few weeks, few months, I suppose, after this story.
Yes. Daniel Payne was a cork cutter who, as I mentioned earlier, was living at the boarding house that Mary Rogers and her mother ran. And he was a man who liked to drink. Of all the things that are known about him, that's the thing that comes up the most often. He was often to be found at taverns. He enjoyed his alcohol. So there's a very sad chapter of this story where he goes out to see the spot where supposedly this wicked deed had happened.
Yeah.
And he wanders around for hours up and down this sort of verge of grass, and people come up and ask him, can we help you? And the following morning, he's found face down, seemingly passed out. A man comes up to him, and there's only one conclusion he can possibly draw. When he sees a man sprawled face down on the grass, he says, sir, are you French? But no, he wasn't French. He had, in fact, passed away.
Yeah.
And it's commonly thought that he killed himself out of remorse. And, of course, this has also given rise to a lot of speculation. Well, why was his conscience so guilty?
Yeah. Well, what do you think? what do you think? What do you think happened? I mean, as you say, there's no one theory that ties it all together, but do you have a sense of what happened?
Yes. And I lay it out in the book. There was a novel written at the time that also suggested that this was a procedure at the home of a secret abortionist that went wrong, and then there was panic,
right.
And in the course of this panic, there was additional damage done to the body that then confused the trail forever after, and then she was dumped in the water, where they hoped she would never appear, but she did wash ashore a few days later.
Yeah. And of course, the case becomes, the context for all of this is this explosive growth going on in New York. In 1841, you talk about the population of the city was something like 300,000 people, and there was all of this concern, you know, that the place really couldn't hold all of these people. And so there's this big case for reform, and what are we going to do about the... I mean, it was, as you say, this impetus for this big kind of social movement almost.
It absolutely was, and a plank of that platform of social reform was the police.
Yeah.
At the time, New York's police was a far cry from what it is. The police force was a far cry from what it is today. It was there was no central authority. It was a patchwork of constables and watchmen, and many of them were moonlighting day laborers or retired soldiers. Some of them didn't even get paid. They sort of cobbled together some earnings out of court fees and private rewards. There wasn't a unified, coherent police force, and there wouldn't be for some time. In fact, when Mary Rogers was killed, the officials of New York and New Jersey each tried to pass off the responsibility for investigating the crime to the other side of the river. The New Jersey people said, look, she was a New Yorker. You guys handle it. And the New York authorities said, look, the body washed up in New Jersey. It's yours. You take it. And this went on for a while. So you can imagine that if there's this kind of squabbling going on about investigating a case of this nature, that it was very hard to get anything done when you were dealing with the police of New York City.
You mentioned one New Yorker who had said of the case that it kind of marked the loss of innocence of New York. And I suppose they meant this question of reform, but it seems like that could also apply to where journalism seemed to go from there. Talk about the influence of this story on where journalism headed or was heading.
Well, the interesting thing was that at this time, each of the city's many newspapers had an axe to grind with City Hall. And in each case, this murder seemed to be a symbol of what was wrong with New York and the way things were done. To some, she was this innocent figure led away to the slaughter, illustrating the failures of the city's law enforcement. And this was written about a great deal at the time. Yeah. But to others, she was a fallen woman led astray by weaknesses of the flesh. And she was an emblem of New York's descent into depravity. And once again, James Gordon Bennett of the Herald took control of this story and sort of wrapped up all the different interpretations. And he said, in one emphatic word, New York is disgraced and dishonored in the eyes of the civilized world.
How did the story do for Edgar Allan Poe? It was reasonably successful, I guess.
It was, but for him, he must have felt that he had dodged a bullet.
Yeah.
Because there was this this awful moment when it looked like he had committed to one solution,
right,
and the story was going to break in a different way, and he was going to wind up with egg on his face. And he managed just barely to escape with his credibility intact after that. But it is worth noting that for all that he had said about, gee, this isn't quite fair with the murders in the Rue Morgue, that I know how it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
With the next story that involved Dupin, which was the purloined letter, he went back to making it up.
Yeah,
he didn't try to solve another real-life crime. He made up the details of the purloined letter out of whole cloth.
Well, that was what I wanted to sort of come to, is it was an experiment, I guess he wasn't entirely committed to this idea of telling the truth in a forum like that. I guess he figured his own imagination may work better, I suppose.
And yet, it was typical of him to try something,
yeah,
and then be satisfied that he had done it and move on. Hmm. Conan Doyle once said of him, it was amazing all of the different types of work that he invented in his casual way and then moved on. And the way Conan Doyle phrased it was, scarcely troubling to repeat a success. The notion was, well, Poe had done it. There was no reason to do it again. He would try something else.
I guess he never really did feel settled then. I mean, you write about his death at the age of 40. What kind of conclusions do you draw about the life that he lived, the style that he settled on? Was he just couldn't quite seem to find, at least for the time, success or contentment or whatever it might have been, even though his stories, of course, have become remarkably successful, remarkably famous, extraordinary, really, in many ways, but they just didn't make it at the time. And I wonder if you figure, you understand why that is.
It's part of his legend, really, that he is the archetype of the poor and struggling writer. And you're right. He was rarely comfortable, and much of the time, just a fingernail's width away from starvation. His life was difficult and peripatetic, to say the least. And it's seldom that there's a man who was so extravagantly gifted, and even his enemies agreed on that, who, we were talking earlier about this self-destructive tendency.
Yeah.
It seemed at several points in his career, just when he was on the brink of something, of some lasting success, he found a way to cut it off at the knees, and he would have to pick up stakes, move somewhere else, and try again. And for that reason, it's remarkable. There are a lot of the different cities in which he lived vying for the honor of being his hometown,
yeah.
Richmond, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New York. Each of them lays claim to him, but it's because he never really stayed long in one place, always moving.
Let me ask you this finally. I'm intrigued by the book you're working on now by Alan Pinkerton, the famed Pinkerton Detective Agency founder. Any connection to Doyle and Poe, or is this just thing different?
Absolutely. I'm fascinated. It's another true crime. I mean, I was drawn to the Cigar Girl story because it was an important true crime, really, that changed the culture in a way that things were never really the same afterwards. And Alan Pinkerton, the detective, was the founder of the Pinkerton Detective Agency. And it was really the world's first well-known, successful private detective agency. The case of a man who literally designed his own badge and his logo, which was an unblinking eye staring out over the words, "We never sleep," is where we get the phrase private eye from. He's America's first private eye, and a lot of the crimes he solved were absolutely unique and could not have been solved in any other way but by someone who had decided that he would ride the rails and cross state lines and push the authority of law enforcement across the entire country.
Well, Daniel Stachel, good luck with that. We'll be back in touch, by the way, about that one when it comes out.
I appreciate that.
Thanks very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Daniel Stachel is the author of the book, The Beautiful Cigar Girl, Mary Rogers, Edgar Allan Poe, and the Invention of Murder. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Olivia Davis and to Matthew Martin. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.